Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is brought to you by Telium, providers of the universal data hub that enables organizations to orchestrate customer data across their data supply chain. Stay tuned to hear from Telium's VP Solutions, Chris Slovak, as he talks to AdExchanger about ensuring data quality and connecting customer identities.
Hey, everyone.
Welcome back to the program. My name is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of AdExchanger and your host. My guest in the studio is Ramsey McGrory, a guy whose career tracks closely with the story of advertising technology and data-driven marketing. He was an early employee at DoubleClick, Max Worldwide, and other companies in the space. His leadership roles include having been president of Right Media under Yahoo, CEO of AdThis, and today he's chief revenue officer at MediaOcean. My first meeting with Ramsey was an interview set up by Yahoo PR, I think. He'd just been named to run Right Media. And that was, goodness gracious, probably 10, 11 years ago.
08, so, probably.
Yeah.
Yep.
So welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. So MediaOcean was acquired 3 years ago by private equity firm Vista Equity. Also, you know, made headlines this summer when it bought Integral Ad Science. So we'll talk about PE and Vista, among many other topics, I hope, over the next 30 minutes. But let's start, Ramsey, with a little bit on your background. Where are you from originally?
So, last child of a preacher and a nurse. My father was in the Air Force, and so we moved around a lot. Born in Okinawa, Nebraska, Michigan, and then my parents retired to Montana. So I still call Montana home. I haven't been there in 25 years. And then after that, I went into the Army myself out of high school and was in Germany and was in the Gulf War. And so jumped around, went to school in the South, University of the South undergrad, and then Georgia Tech.
Was it a given you were going to join?
No, my dad was...
Some families, it's just required, you know, military families.
My brother was career. He was Navy First Army. It was more functional for me, so...
Okay.
You know, he was a chaplain. My mom was a nurse. I screwed around in high school, and I needed to pay my own way. So the Army was, for me, an opportunity to grow up and see the world, and I was in Germany, which was amazing. And then I had money.
Right.
To come back and go to school, GI Bill.
I'm a GI Bill.
Okay.
Yep. Where'd you go to school?
University of the South. It's a small D3 school in Tennessee.
Got it.
And then lived in Atlanta for a couple of years, did the 92 presidential campaign, and then went to Georgia Tech. And that was early internet, so 95, 97. So it's like the early edition of a tech MBA at a great engineering school.
And you immediately jumped into digital advertising, but it was in its most nascent form.
I was hired from Georgia Tech to work at Citibank.
Oh, okay.
And I was in their management program in their global trading business, which was focused on derivatives, so debt and credit derivatives. And after 2 years, I didn't like the culture. I didn't really like what I was doing. I felt like I needed to be a CPA to really understand what I was going to do. But to me, it was an exciting, crazy business that was data-driven. And so there's this constant theme throughout my career, which has always been like, how does data and technology, you know, make something better? And so that was logistics in the Gulf War, derivatives in banking. And then I just lucked into getting hired at DoubleClick. The person that hired me to Citibank had moved over to DoubleClick and called me up and said, I don't know if you'll like this, but they have great parties. It's early internet. It's a young, cool place, and and we'll pay you $32,000 and commissions to come over and sell. And so that was the beginning of my advertising career in the late 90s.
And were you selling to publishers?
I was
advertisers?
Selling to advertisers.
Okay.
And I ended up working in the business vertical, which was insurance and financial services. So I was doing some of the early, early hardcore DR stuff for insurance companies about how can we get a quote for $50 from the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got into the data side of advertising because the advertisers were demanding it.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of stayed in that spot where I was always looking at what data was available, what technology was being used, and for what purpose, whether it was content or advertising or any other purpose.
Mm-hmm. And at that stage in your career, you're looking around, you're making some decent money, I imagine, selling digital ads and ad tech.
Yeah.
And did you think, well, this is it. This is I can build a career out of this.
I loved the advertising space because of the chaos that was happening, because of the transformation that was happening, because of all the different people that were in it. You had the old school advertising, literally the Mad Men who were still around. And then you had the newer companies that were focused on tech and data. And I just felt like it was a vibrant place to be. And as I got more knowledgeable about it, I got into positions where I could influence. And so for me, that was Wright Media. So I joined in early 2004 as head of sales, Mike Walrath, the founder.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to just build a better ad network and a better ad server.
Yep.
And very quickly that morphed into, what I say are the three things that led to Wright Media success, which was dynamic pricing. That was early RTB. That was the first iteration of RTB that Brian O'Kelly created. And that was late 2004.
Mm-hmm.
It was licensing the technology. We had ad networks come to us and say, we like the technology. Can we license it? And we said, well, we can run our own ad network or we can enable others.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was after licensing the tech to four players, Wright Media, Iridian, AdTech, AdTegrity, and CPX, that they all bought and sold into each other. And probably late 2004, early 2005, Brian looked at this and said, we built this wrong. And in 6 or 7 weeks, he built Yield Manager, which ended up being the exchange platform that became the exchange and all the success that came from it.
Okay, great. And at that time, the idea of an exchange, real time, calling it real time is generous, but it was moderating between different ad network sources, so helping the publisher.
Well, it was real time, but the way it was built, you had to push all the intelligence into Wright Media to allow the real time auction to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the change there, the innovation happened there when the DSPs started to say, no, I don't want the decisioning to happen inside of Wright Media. I want you to call out to me and I'll make the decision in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the early innovator there was Poindexter early on.
Right,
Joe Zawadzki.
Mm-hmm.
Which became X Plus One, and then he started MediaMath. So it started as a real-time auction, and then the exchange space fragmented, and rather than everyone putting intelligence into the underlying exchange, you had DSPs, you had the DMPs. Not long after, you had the SSPs coming.
Mm-hmm.
So it very quickly, in the span of 2 or 3 years, began to fragment and diversify in a really interesting way that I think continues to this day.
Mm-hmm. And what's your point of view on how Wright Media sort of evolved and struggled under Yahoo during those years?
I think when Yahoo acquired it, they looked at it partly as how can I solve my unsold inventory problem, what they called class two. Anything that wasn't direct sold, they had sold it off to four different advertisers, all of it, literally billions of impressions a day.
Right.
And so they looked at that and said, there's a huge yield management opportunity
there. They were looking at it as a platform to offload and just increase yield from their own remnant.
That's right. And and bring a significant amount of demand. And in very short order, the underlying Wright Media, all the demand that came from it, quadrupled the yield. So when Yahoo looks at Wright Media and the acquisition and the payback was within 2 years.
Yep.
But what Yahoo did not do was fully invest in the broader exchange strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, wanted to move away from what was some of the more innovative and riskier players who were licensing the technology.
Ad networks who weren't getting supported,
but were also being the most permissive, the most risky, and the most aggressive. And that actually created the opportunity that AppNexus came in, stepped in, and started signing those left and right, and very quickly consolidated all of that. I put a proposal together with some colleagues in late 08 to sell parts of the rate media business to AppNexus. It didn't get approved.
Interesting.
I think Brian and Michael and the team at AppNexus did a fantastic job consolidating that and then building on it to become the player that they were. And God bless Brian for being committed to that vision from, you know, late 03 to now.
Yeah, totally. Although, as you point out, like the ad networks that were licensing the right media technology, many of them there were major problems with the inventory, including, you know, quality and what we would now call fraud and viewability, which weren't even really on anyone's radar at that point.
That's right.
But a lot of just kind of junk. And then AppNexus, which was...
Well, look, it was unsold. Yeah. And part of that was that there was junk. And let's be more specific about junk, high frequency inventory that is, you know, multiple ad units on a page, potentially fraudulent inventory, a constant battle between the underlying exchange, the buyers, and the sellers and intermediaries.
Impression arbitrage was a big one at those times. Getting someone to click and then load a page that's only ads kind of thing, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So fair enough. But it's just interesting that... AppNexus and Brian O'Kelly came in and took those customers from Yahoo, which Yahoo had just sort of shown the door.
Yeah.
And...
Well, ignored, neglected.
Right. Okay. And eventually
All
fired.
Of those ad networks wanted access to Yahoo inventory, so they would stay. They would keep their, quote, seat.
Okay.
But they ended up moving, many of them ended up moving to AppNexus.
Okay.
And, you know, at the time of the acquisition, Brian transitioned out and started AppNexus.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took about a year for Brian and Mike Nolet and others to really gear up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still early days in programmatic.
Yes, indeed. And the rest is history for AppNexus.
Yeah.
You know, they eventually did a similar cleanup to what Yahoo had done after using that ad network revenue to grow over the...
Fund their business,
right. Yeah. Leading to an acquisition by AT&T. I hope we get a chance to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah.
But let's charge ahead on your own background and talk just a little bit about Procter & Gamble and the origin of Hawkeye. Because this is kind of... this is now ad tech canon, what happened there. And could you just tell that story?
Yeah. So was leading... sales at Right Media. So this would be 08 before I had taken over ad platforms and was in a Yahoo offsite with P&G. And Yahoo has been and remains a significant partner of P&G. And so P&G would do these innovation days. And the head of media purchasing at the time was a guy named Bob Deese. Mm-hmm. And Bob walked up to me and we had talked before. And he said, I want to build an ad network. And I said, I have no idea what that means, but let's sit down and talk about it. And so it took about a year conversation. But their strategy was to take more control of the programmatic process with their agencies, in concert with the agencies, but take much greater control of the data and the process of buying programmatic.
Mm.
And they had done enough tests to show that there was real value there. The conversations developed over the better part of a year.
Mm-hmm.
We locked in the pilot with them. During that process, there were some underlying ways about how we stored data with Right Media that they weren't particularly long-term happy with. And so I actually brought audience science into the equation. At the time, it was Jeff Hirsch and Basim.
Right.
Brought them in. They had server-side cookie stores. And audience science ended up becoming the DMP for P&G.
Right. A relationship that lasted 10 years and ended in the ignominious firing of audience science last year by Procter & Gamble.
Yeah.
And the failure of audience science's business within a month of that, which is remarkable. And
we could spend
a whole episode on that. Yeah.
Look, I think they had, I don't know if you've had Mike or Jeff Hirsch on, but I think they doubled down. They said, if this is, you know, as P&G goes, so goes the market. Let's take this strategy and go out there. Remember, at the time, there were a lot of growing dead companies. What Terry Kawaja called the growing dead, which is growing in revenue but not strategic value. Mm. And so a media network, Audience Science, was growing their media business, but no strategic wanted to acquire that. What they wanted was the tech and the underlying process and the clients.
Yeah.
And so I think Audience Science made the shift and said, we're going to get out of the ad network business. Mm-hmm. We're going to stop selling media, and we're just going to be a tech provider.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, didn't necessarily execute on that. There were other companies that came in with second mover advantage.
Right.
And out-executed. And
sure.
So when P&G decided to part ways with Audience Science, I think it was a quick demise.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a moment's break, hear from a sponsor, and be right back with Ramsey. Hi, I'm here with Chris Slovak, VP Solution at Telium, our sponsor for this episode. Chris, you hear the phrase single view of the customer, like a great deal. What does that really mean, and how does Telium support that?
Yeah, you do hear that a lot, don't you? Well, I think the first thing is it's not just a database to report on. Really, it's about understanding the customer across any touch point or interaction that they're having. And it's not just about getting them to convert or creating data about conversions. It's about servicing and support and nurturing, right? It's about understanding who a customer really is to the business. And for us, we think that it's not about a view or a reporting system. It's about getting that data to the edge, right? Empowering tools and teams with the same data, the same view, if you will, right? So they can build great experiences regardless of where the customer is in their life cycle or what touch points they have with the brand.
Okay, great. Now, what conversations come up with your customers most often?
So I spent a lot of time on the road, and I think one of the biggest things that I hear about is this idea of privacy and governance. And you know, people jump right into the regulations, but I think that there's something that has to be considered first and foremost, which is that there's a value exchange that's happening. A customer, when they interact with a brand or they give their data to a brand, there's an exchange there of trust, right? I'm giving you my data so that you can build great products and support me and give me great services. And I think as brands, we need to think about that sort of trust as very critical and use that data for the good of the customer, not just the good of the business.
Why is it critical, that companies facilitate in-the-moment experiences?
Well, customers don't think about omnichannel, right? Even though they're using an app or they're going to your website or they're walking in your store, for them, it's just the brand. It's just an experience and a touch point that they're having with your organization. And we've got to make sure that personalization isn't just about conversions, right? Marketing is bigger than marketing. It's about talking to the customer and building a great brand relationship and servicing them. So for us, really, it's about thinking in terms of not shouting, but listening and reacting and treating your customers to some extent as your friends. And one of the things that's really interesting that you've got to consider there is really the data that you use has to be clean and consistent. Right, because you can't just guess anymore. You've got to be accurate when it comes to having a conversation with a friend, you know, in that one-to-one, if you will.
All right. Chris from Telium, thanks for supporting the podcast.
Thank you.
All right, and I'm back with Ramsey McRory, ad tech historian and media and MediaOcean chief revenue officer. Let's talk about MediaOcean. We could spend forever on P&G and AppNexus and Yahoo, but MediaOcean is a company known for providing software to agencies. That's how I think of it historically.
Yep. Historically, yep.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about this company's place in the industry and how it's changed over time and since you joined?
Sure. So Mediaocean is actually over 50 years old. So part of that business is the legacy Donovan Data Systems, which was the system that all of the holding companies used to buy traditional media. Literally mm-hmm. grew up in the television industry. Mm-hmm. And that was a vertically integrated system that allowed for the planning, buying, and bill payment. So, you know, we are a foundational provider to the holding companies and all of the constituents, the, you know, the brands that the agencies serve and the sellers that integrate and the tech providers, whether it's on the traditional side like a Nielsen or a Comscore, or on the digital side. There are literally hundreds of companies that integrate into technology that we have to enable the planning, buying, selling, and payment of media.
Okay, great. So this is a company that would seem very well positioned to capitalize on the automation trend yeah. in marketing overall, mm-hmm. Especially as it moves into, you know, sort of process improvements, which seems to be the latest wave of innovations.
Yeah.
Things like direct deals and reconciliation and blockchain, which all seem, they seem to be areas where Mediaocean could sort of bring some innovation. So yeah. What are you all doing from a sort of technology and product standpoint?
So I'll give you a sense of vision that will inform what we do from a, you know, strategy and tactic perspective, mm-hmm. which is I think the arc of media is long, but it bends towards accountability. Mm-hmm. And this is programmatic thinking. And by programmatic, I mean massive data and automation. And in the world where the customer journey is fragmenting, where the way you touch a consumer changes, and there's literally tens of different touch points that you have across paid, earned, and owned, and everything inside of that. And given that marketers have to make fundamental decisions about how they invest a dollar of capital. Do I build a new product? Mm. Do I create a retail strategy like a Warby Parker? Do I create an e-commerce strategy? Do I change pricing? In that world, the brands must have a sense of what the impact of marketing is. We talk about the accountable marketing agenda and Mediaocean being the operating system for accountable marketing. So in the context of this theme of accountable marketing, you know, Mediaocean is focused on how do we deliver an underlying financial and operational system to allow for the brands to have much greater cross-media visibility into the impact of advertising, mm-hmm. meaning television, print, radio, digital, all of it. And in the last 10 years, media has fragmented in a way that's made it very difficult. And so we are focused on being a foundational software provider to the entire industry, neutral and open. We're a software provider. We don't arbitrage media. We don't buy and sell media. That the brands use, that the agencies use, that the sellers integrate into, and that the value-added tech and data and supply partners integrate into to automate the process, to speed the process of understanding what the impact of media is.
Is the agency still your primary customer?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, still a primary customer, but the world is changing. Mm-hmm. You know, many brands, I would argue that the role of the CMO used to be understanding the consumer and the voice of the brand. And now a large role of that marketer, that CMO, is the coordination of the marketing and technology infrastructure that mm-hmm. enables all that data to be accessible and actionable. Mm-hmm. And so you've seen things like the Chase CMO, Kristen, hire media folks. You've seen things like brands take parts of media buying in-house in an effort to internalize the expertise and the capabilities around marketing.
Okay.
In that world where there are studies that show that brand loyalty is decreasing significantly, and I would argue that in that world and in the world where brand consumers want to consume digitally, the role of marketing is even more important. Mm-hmm. And now in a fragmented world, you have to have all the data, all the infrastructure in place, understanding there are legacy ways of buying television that will continue for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. That has to be integrated with more programmatic, real-time, data-driven thinking so that a brand can look at this and say, I'm spending a dollar of media. What's the impact of that dollar?
Mm-hmm.
Not just like brand metrics, but like real sales metrics.
So you guys were acquired 3 years ago by Vista Equity.
Yeah.
This is a company that's really kind of moved aggressively in media and marketing technology.
They have.
They own Marketo. This summer, they took a majority stake in Integral Ad Science, $800 million valuation after that that deal. I'm curious about Vista, what they're thinking and what they bring.
Yeah. So Vista is a significant private equity company that focuses on software and is in many, if not all, of the verticals. And up until 5 years ago, was not a significant investor in the media space.
Mm-hmm.
And so MarketTrack and MediaOcean and Marketo and IAS, and there may be more, they're very aggressive, very thoughtful. For MediaOcean, we're 3 years in, what they bring to us has been a rigor about how to operate mm-hmm. an enterprise-class software company. And so they built up this knowledge base of best practices mm-hmm. called VSOPs that we apply in the business. And some of them are technology-driven, and some are process-driven.
Mm.
And we've even developed best practices that we've pushed in support-based support via chat. 40%+ of our support happens through chat, and mm-hmm. so we built a Vista best practice around that and allowed it to get disseminated out.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, it's been professionalizing the company: how you hire, how you do product marketing, how you plan product, how you develop product, how you measure the impact of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for not being operators in our space, they are exceptionally fluent in the space.
Mm-hmm.
And they're aggressive and supportive of our efforts. We've done 6 acquisitions over the last 2 years. We've done an acquisition in China that we haven't announced. I just sort of announced it. and we'll continue to do that as we see geographic opportunity or product opportunity
mm-hmm.
in this framework of driving accountable marketing
mm-hmm.
and being the underlying operating system to do it.
Okay. Will MediaOcean continue to operate as a standalone within Vista, or do you see other moves, some such as a roll-up or anything structural that we can anticipate?
You know, that might be above my pay grade, so, but here's what I'll say.
Well, you're all I got.
You're all I got. we operate independently.
Okay.
We get together with the other media companies, the other Vista companies,
yeah.
and share best practices. We're encouraged to work together. We're not, there's no demand
mm-hmm.
to do it. And, you know, our goal is to build a growing, profitable company where we can invest in new products, and that's geographic products, that's new market segments,
yeah.
and new modules in that framework of accountable marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So never say never. There's yeah. lots of options that we have going forward. But, you know, as I said, I'm focused on the operations and the growth of the business.
The sort of friction in media buying is still significant when
yeah.
it comes to reconciliation, billing, and various aspects of the handshake between buyers and sellers. And a lot of people seem to think there's an opportunity to fix that this year and in the coming 5 years, maybe.
Yeah.
Just dramatically improve speed of payment and terms, agreement on terms, and
Actually, I only sort of understand how that whole world works. But blockchain is part of the solution, according to some people. And I'm curious what you could say about process improvements and whether you see that as a big opportunity for you all, or do you think it's not?
So I'll talk about some of the themes where I think there's real value.
Okay.
You mentioned the buy-sell. How you more tightly couple the buying and the selling technology to allow people to not focus on the manual steps in the process of a PO, an IO, an invoice, a reconciliation, and a payment, mm-hmm. but actual like value, cross-media buying and selling. Mm. So that's part one. Planning and buying. In a world that's more programmatic, planning and buying have to be iterative, and so those things have to integrate together. Mm-hmm. Now, underlying that, we see blockchain as a significant opportunity to improve what we already do. We are the ad ledger for the holding companies. Mm-hmm. So all the POs, the IOs, the invoices, the payments, all those transactions happen in our system. Mm. And we have instances of ad ledgers for each of the holding companies.
Okay.
Blockchain allows us to transform the way we deliver that and in a way that can be far more automated and far more efficient. And I think the challenge of blockchain right now is, much like early programmatic, there's a lot of hot air and global warming is being affected by the hot air associated with blockchain. But if you break it down, blockchain has several layers of value that can be driven. First is the financial, and that's where we are strong and where we think we'll apply blockchain in a smart way. We announced an IBM partnership at Cannes focused on a pilot with 5 major brands and their agency partners and some sellers mm-hmm. around applying blockchain to the financial process. Over and above that, you have applications. And it's like fraud and reconciliation are great examples of applications of blockchain where you can solve a particular need. Now, whether those companies are long-term, profitable and standalone, or whether those are features of another company, the market will figure that out. We don't have an opinion. But every time someone has said, I think you're competitive with so-and-so, we sit down with those companies and find that it's not actually competitive. Mm-hmm. Over and above that, you hear companies talking about consumer identity as a blockchain opportunity. And that's absolutely the case. So I think we're spending a lot of time talking with people about the different layers mm-hmm. of blockchain application. We think the formative and foundational one is the application of blockchain for the financial transactions so that the brands, their agencies, the DSPs, the DMPs, the sellers can write into a blockchain that is a consortium blockchain, mm-hmm. private by design, that allows them to have data at much greater speed and automation than they do right now.
And brands will see exactly how much money all the constituents in the supply chain are making. What could go wrong?
Well, that's the value. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the folks that will get pressed are the intermediaries.
Right.
When you
does
look
that include
at,
agencies or no?
I think less so because by and large that game has played out in the transparency reports, and by and large the agencies have very transparent businesses, and if they're not transparent, they have to be transparent about not being transparent, and the brands buy into the value or they don't. So I think less so on the agency side, more so on the intermediary side.
Fair enough. On the topic of agencies, this is a competitive set that has changed remarkably little over the last 20 years, given the immense changes in the world and in the business environment and the rise of the internet. But this year feels a little different. We've got some of the consultants achieving real scale in digital marketing, and we have some odd developments and within the holding company group and the leadership of those companies. I won't get too much into that because we're running out of time.
Yeah.
But Martin Sorrell splitting off from WPP and launching his own new holding company-like organization. And you also have poor earnings, 2 years of weak growth or no growth mm-hmm. from some of these companies. Do you think that a delayed disruption is kicking in for the agency groups, or what do you see for that competitive set, your customers?
Yeah, I think the space is transforming. I think the agencies are both in a tough position and in a great position. By and large, trusted by their brand partners. And in the world of change, you know, being at the center of that and having an opinion about that change and how to take advantage of it is a great opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I think there are many agencies making investments in answering that fundamental question of what value does my marketing bring and how do I maximize that value and minimize the inputs against that. The consulting companies like an Accenture, I think, are attacking. But I also think they try to answer a slightly different question. And the question they're answering is, how do I grow the business? And that may mean building out e-commerce, building out retail, developing product. You know, it's a broader question. Mm-hmm. So is there some overlap? Yeah, I think so. But in many cases, they're answering different questions. I think brands, to some detriment, to some of their own detriment, have treated the holding companies or even the operating agencies like slightly differentiated commodity services and bid them down over the years. And that's exactly what should not be happening in the time frame that we're in, where so much change is happening. You need to be investing in that. So I think brands are beginning to think about, what should I do? What can I have my agency partner do? How do I make sure that I understand the strategy, the execution, and then how does my agency act as a trusted partner in that regard? And there are tons of examples. We tend to focus on the negative ones because they get a lot of press. But I think there are great agency relationships that are decade long, and all of the different holding companies are in different phases of investing in software and data and people and process and organization to help their brands transform.
All right, great. Well, we could go on, but we're over time. So thank you so much, Ramsey, for coming in. This was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, listener. We'll see you next week.
Stay tuned next week to hear more conversations with Tealium. Visit Tealium.com/AdExchanger to learn more about how Tealium is helping companies intelligently orchestrate customer data. Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.